The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I don't think anyone really knows what the right answer is. I do think it's positive that some of the platforms are at least trying to change their policies and trying to create thoughtful policies to deal with these issues. But you're right, some of it is a bit of a band-aid. You're definitely not going to stop disinformation just by having, say, a more honest advertisement policy. But we have seen that this idea of being able to target an advertisement towards a certain population, that has allowed for some disinformation campaigns to reach certain populations and to really spread and proliferate there. So potentially, this could help a lot. But I think I also want to talk about your point of this being a more general problem, right? The problem isn't just disinformation. The problem is really that we have so much data being collected about us and used against us, and we don't really have that many limitations on what companies can do with it.
I'm Quinta Juretic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 12th, 2019. Today we're bringing you a new episode from our Arbiters of Truth series on disinformation in the run-up to the 2020 election. This week, Evelyn Dweck, Alina Polyakova, and I spoke with Tiffany Lee, a visiting professor at Boston University and a fellow at the Information Society Project at Yale Law School. Tiffany writes on all the issues we've been discussing on this podcast, disinformation, misinformation, and platform governance, but with an additional twist. She's also a privacy scholar. We talked about how privacy law can inform platform governance and how prioritizing privacy might help tackle disinformation, as well as what tensions there might be between those two goals. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 484, Tiffany Lee on Privacy and Disinformation. Tiffany, I figured we'd start off by just giving you the opportunity to introduce yourself and tell us what you work on.
Great. So I am a visiting professor at Boston University School of Law, where I teach in the Technology Law Clinic. And I am also a fellow at Yale Law School's Information Society Project. My research focuses on a few things: privacy, AI, and a lot right now on technology platform governance.
So Tiffany, it's great to have you on the podcast. You and I met in the context of a panel where I was really fascinated by some of your comments around applying privacy law to this broader issue of disinformation, which is, of course, the subject of our podcast. So I guess to start off, just a bigger question, you know, privacy and disinformation are two areas of studies that seem to exist in a similar space, especially as they relate to the role of big platforms. But they aren't always seen as overlapping beyond just this very basic level of, you know, Facebook is scary and powerful. But how do you see them as connecting?
That's an interesting question. I think privacy generally talks about a few things, mostly data and identity. So personal data being collected, being used, being shared, and now that links to personal identity, right? Securing your privacy relates to your private thoughts, relates to your ability to express your identity freely, so on and so forth. On the other hand, I think disinformation is slightly different, right? We also talk about data when we talk about disinfo, but we're talking about the spread of ideas as opposed to thinking about the spread or the securing of personal data.
So one thing that you said that I thought was really fascinating is how privacy law is a imperfect or perhaps partial solution to the spread of disinformation. But there are ways in which we don't have to really reinvent the wheel, but to think through how existing privacy law can be applied to the problem of deterring, countering, or mitigating the spread of disinformation. Can you talk us through that a little bit more?
Sure. I think there are a few ways in which existing and potential privacy laws could affect disinformation. And there are ways in which we can think of privacy laws as actually protecting us against some of the harms of disinformation. I think the first thing that's most relevant is simply the idea of privacy law as protecting against the harms of targeted advertising or of algorithmic targeting for social media posts, for example.
And so if we think about it in that sense, is the argument that limiting ad targeting would then decrease or slow disinformation, or are the two not so closely linked?
I think the argument there is it's a little complex. So first, we have to analyze whether or not people actually look at disinformation or look at posts involving disinformation more if they are targeted towards them using their personal data. And here, I think the research is not wholly conclusive. I've read some studies that have talked about how ad targeting, for example, based on personal data, is not actually more accurate or not actually better at persuading people than regular ads that are based on things like basic demographics. So we can't really be sure if disinformation spreads faster due to ad targeting or due to post targeting. However, if that is the case, then we have to think about how we could possibly limit this targeting factor. And if we can limit that targeting factor, then we might be able to limit the spread of disinformation.
So again, I mean, I think this is a really interesting topic to cover right now because all of the companies are under a lot of pressure to change their political ad policies. Obviously, Twitter came out of the gate first and just said, that's it, we're not doing more political ads. Then Google followed up with their own policy, and Facebook may be following up depending on when we release this podcast. But does any of this actually matter when we're talking about disinformation? How does just not allowing political ads on Twitter have any effect on disinformation and the spread of disinformation on that platform?
Right. The political ads policies for these platforms will definitely have an impact on the spread of disinformation. I think one thing that we have seen happen over and over again is that certain interests will use targeted political advertisements that include various false information or misleading information to spread messages that are, you know, counterproductive or counter to what we would consider to be democratic values. And that's a big problem. So ideally, these political ads policies would help to stem that a little bit, to help either stop the flow of disinformation or at least stop or slow the amplification of it.
So it's about slowing the amplification potentially, although I still have a hard time seeing how this is not just a Band-Aid on top of a really huge problem, which has a lot less to do with political ads, right, and a lot more to do with, you know, how personal information is being used in general by the platforms to allow the kind of micro-targeting or specific distribution to, you know, targeted sectors of the population, which, of course, these are the very tools that we've seen be exploited by malicious actors over and over again. And I think what's interesting is that one of the early responses to some of the changes that Facebook is considering, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, Tiffany, as well, is by groups from campaigns. Obviously, we're in election season right now, and a lot of campaigns, or I say most campaigns and digital strategies, use these very same tools to deliver messages to their targeted audience, to mobilize voter support, et cetera. And they're also now complaining that, well, look, if you, Facebook, start limiting our ability to target in these very specific ways, you actually take away our key ability to communicate with our voters. And so it seems like, you know, these companies, I have some sympathy for them, that they're kind of stuck in the middle, where on the one hand, they're being told, stop disinformation. They say, okay, well, this is one way in which we're trying to get around the problem. And then when they do that, they get the other side, which is saying, but wait, we need these tools for, you know, legitimate democratic purposes of political campaigning. So what's kind of the sweet middle there? What do you think?
That's really hard. It's really hard for these platforms to figure out what to do, which, you know, a number of you have worked on and talked about a lot. I don't think anyone really knows what the right answer is. I do think it's positive that some of the platforms are at least trying to change their policies and trying to create thoughtful policies to deal with these issues. But you're right, some of it is a bit of a band-aid. You're definitely not going to stop disinformation just by having, say, a more honest advertisement policy. But we have seen that this idea of being able to target an advertisement towards a certain population, that has allowed for some disinformation campaigns to reach certain populations and to really spread and proliferate there. So potentially, this could help a lot. But I think I also want to talk about your point of this being a more general problem, right? The problem isn't just disinformation. The problem is really that we have so much data being collected about us and used against us, and we don't really have that many limitations on what companies can do with it.
So one of the interesting sort of rabbit holes that this leads us down, I think, is not only how limiting ad targeting could affect disinformation in terms of, you know, false, you know, political ads or something like that, but particular forms of disinformation. The big one I have in mind is deepfakes. So if we're thinking about privacy in connection with deepfakes, what advantage does that framing give us?
So deepfakes are definitely an issue that people have talked about in the disinformation space. I'm sure many of us have seen those videos that have been made that appear to show certain politicians saying things that they have never said before. So this kind of deep fake could be potentially very problematic. There are a few ways that privacy and privacy law could help to stop those deep fakes, or at least to allow for a mechanism for them to be taken down. There are legal theories that could support, for example, the ownership of a certain right over your image or the use of your image. And this sort of privacy right could allow for someone to ask, for example, a platform to take down a video that appears to show them saying something they don't like or something that didn't happen. We've also seen this in the context of non-consensual pornography or revenge porn, when people have been able to ask or request content takedowns based on various legal theories that include actually copyright law.
So I have a quick follow-up to that. I mean, are you basically saying that a natural extension of privacy laws, we currently have them on the books, which don't really address digital issues more broadly, but we're moving closer and closer toward, you know, the proliferation of facial recognition technologies combined with the capabilities that algorithms provide to produce these kind of deepfake videos, that somebody should have basically the right to their face? Is that what we're talking about here?
So we have that right now, and that's something. There are a few legal theories for that, the chief one being the right of publicity, that you have certain rights over your likeness or your image, and you have the ability to control that to some extent. There are limitations, of course, and the limitations are one reason why people are concerned about deepfakes, because deepfakes could fall into different categories that could allow for free posting, for example, being parodies or something like that. So those are problems, but we can envision a scenario in which privacy law could encompass some of these issues, right? We can think of privacy as more than just the protection of the data that you put into a platform or the data collected about you in the workplace. Privacy could be a larger concept, and we could think of privacy law as including some of those protections for things like your image or your identity, or protecting against some harms that are harder to quantify.
So something I'm struck by with that framing is how individual those rights are, the right to your face, your identity. But a lot of the time, there seems to be a real market failure here because so many consumers and users do just happily hand over their data all the time. I get in trouble in a lot of privacy circles when I say, you know, sometimes I don't mind targeted ads. So what sort of tools does privacy law have, if any, to sort of help address these kind of negative externalities to privacy harms, where the individual feels okay about what's happening, but we have a societal damage with all of this data accumulating?
That's really funny. This is something I've also gotten into trouble with. I have, you know, gone on record saying that, for example, Amazon Ring may not be the most terrible technology ever invented in the history of human technology, right? There are many types of consumer technologies that seem a little creepy and have bad externalities, but are very useful. And people like convenience. People like technology. Sometimes we like targeted ads. They give you brands that you may actually want to buy. Sometimes we like technologies like Siri or like Google Home or digital assistants that allow us to do things without actually typing things into a computer or a phone. It's true that consumers want technologies that occasionally are privacy invasive. I think what's important here is twofold. That first, the companies have to realize their responsibilities, both legal and otherwise, to protect consumer data so that they can have still a strong market advantage. But also, we need to make sure that we regulate the technology sector generally and data collection specifically so we can protect consumers even when they do want these technologies. I think we can have these technologies. We just need to make sure we implement them and develop them in a way that is protective of privacy.
So that, I think, gets to a much bigger question, which is, what are the sort of big changes in technology in recent years that privacy regulation has failed to adapt to on a high level?
That is a key question. So the question of how society has changed is really important in understanding how the law should change. And one of my mentors, Professor Jack Balkin at Yale Law School, he has always spoken about the importance of technology law as not just dealing with new technologies simply because they're new, but looking at what has changed in society so that these technologies have changed as well. And when you understand what has changed about society, then you can figure out how the law should change. So here I think we have a few societal changes that are important to understand when we think about how to change privacy laws or how to update them to allow for protection against disinformation, for example. And one of the greatest societal changes is simply the proliferation of data. So the big data world is one of the biggest changes. The fact that you walk outside and data is being collected about you from numerous actors, many of which you don't know, that's something that's new. In the past, you generally knew when data was being collected about you. Today, you don't, and there's almost no way to control how the data is later shared or transferred or aggregated.
It strikes me on that point with the massive accumulation of data that we're seeing that we're actually in this very unique moment in history where we could study things like disinformation in a way that we could never do before. Platforms have so much information about how it spreads, who spreads it, what is effective counter speech, etc. But here is where we run into privacy from a different angle. So in the study of disinformation or when there are campaigns happening in real time, there are concerns about privacy, about letting too much data out to let either researchers or counter speech campaigns in. And there sort of seems like a real tension there. And you can understand, you have some sympathy for the platforms to sort of be very nervous about the privacy harms, especially in the wake of Cambridge Analytica and things. So how do you conceive of that trade-off there? And is there any way to sort of move forward from this point where we have this bit of a stalemate?
It's really interesting when you talk to people who are trying to do research on the platforms, which involve many of us on this podcast right now. It's difficult to get data from the platforms. If you want hard data on how people are talking to each other, how people are interacting, this involves either very creative use of the platforms to scrape various types of data, or talking to the platforms themselves and asking for data directly from them. Of course, post-Cambridge Analytica, many platforms have kind of locked down their access for researchers. And this is a good and bad thing. It could be good in that we could prevent the next Cambridge Analytica from happening, right? We could limit a bad faith researcher from taking too much data. It's also potentially bad because there are probably many more good faith researchers who could use data even data that could potentially re-identify a person solely in a research capacity. And this research could be on topics that could relate to disinformation. It could be about disinformation actors, about the spread and the amplification of disinfo, all of those things that are very important for us to study right now. So I am concerned about the over-application of privacy issues and privacy law in stopping research on tech platforms.
So what I have found fascinating about the individual kind of user side of this is that it seems like individuals are also starting to realize that their personal data is worth money, right? And in a way, they're learning that they have something to sell. And we saw this pretty clearly in the Ukrainian elections that took place over the spring and summer, where there was a confession by a Russian agent who said he was sent to Ukraine around the elections to try to get people to rent out their Facebook accounts. And then they would have this organic account that they could then use to, you know, post political ads or publish all kinds of false stories or what have you. And, you know, right now, if you Google rent out my Facebook, there's plenty of companies that specialize in this. And this to me seems like, you know, the next phase of the gig economy, right? Where people are realizing that their data is worth something. It's not just worth something to the companies and then to the advertisers trying to sell products. It also could be worth something to them, right? And I just wonder where, like, this is all heading. And one thing that I have put out there, nobody has really yelled at me about this, although I don't think it's a good idea necessarily, but I'd love to get your thoughts, is I've suggested that it would be really useful to require sort of disclosures where companies are basically required to tell you, if you request that information, how much you're worth to them, right? Because we all have a dollar sign on us when it comes to the kinds of advertising that's reaching us, how appealing we are to certain advertisers. I mean, is this just a completely crazy idea? Or do you think this is something that, I mean, could at least raise awareness about how data is collected, how much of it is collected, and what is its worth value to the individual?
I think that's an interesting idea. I don't know if it's crazy. It's certainly, you know, not something that we've seen implemented in the law. I think that what you're talking about here, this idea of the worth of a user's data, it's not so much about how much data costs. It's about the user account, or really the user identity. And we've seen this. We've seen different companies buy user accounts in order to then flip them and use them for disinformation or for advertising. I just read an article recently about this phenomenon where people are now Amazon reviewers for products for pay. So what they essentially do is they sign up on Amazon, they have an account, and they also sign up on an external website to be a paid reviewer. This external website pays them completely off Amazon to review certain products. These people then go on Amazon, actually buy the product, and then review it as a verified purchaser. So there's no money being exchanged between Amazon and the reviewer, but the reviewer is getting paid based on their appearance of having a real Amazon account. And I think that's very similar. We're talking about the issue of people selling their appearance or their identity or their account. It's not so much selling your data, which I think is different and scarier. If you sell a user account on Facebook or a user account on Twitter or Amazon, that's one discrete thing. And that's something we can get a price on. We could have a marketing company just price how much a certain account is worth. You can think of this in terms of a proxy, for example, how much an influencer of different follower account is paid for a certain advertisement. The idea of getting paid for your data generally is scarier, though, because it gets into this really scary concept to me, which is simply the idea of data brokers and data aggregators owning more data than anyone can really understand. I think we understand that we each have, you know, one social media account here, one account there, and that we have discrete data collected by those companies in each of those accounts. What we probably don't grasp is the enormity of how much data exists that is just on us out there, controlled by the various aggregators.
And so what solutions does privacy law have for that, or does it have any?
There are various privacy laws that are trying to control against this idea of big data aggregation. Many privacy laws, though, are not really set up in a way to protect against those secondary or, let's say, downstream harms. Privacy laws protect against the collection of data. They limit the collection of data. They limit the first use of data. They limit the first sale or transfer of data. And they allow for certain rights sometimes, like the right to access or the right to deletion. What we should be more concerned about, though, is the harms of aggregation and the harms that come from these large-scale data brokers. And what I haven't really seen so far are any good laws that really regulate the data brokers. I've seen a few proposals and a few laws that try to at least identify them, but nothing that really regulates against their specific harms.
So I want to jump back to a question that I think combines deepfakes and what we were just discussing about selling accounts, though not selling data itself, which is, if you're talking about, you know, someone who sort of rents out their Amazon account or rents out their Facebook account, that strikes me as another example of something we've talked about a lot on this podcast, which is a sort of a degradation in trust. Right? That, you know, now if I look at Amazon reviews, I don't necessarily trust that, you know, all these 5-star reviews are legitimate, even though, say, a few years ago, I might have been a little more naive and said, wow, like, everyone loves this light bulb so much. And so bringing that into the political realm, one thing that I've seen recently that's really interesting is the Pete Buttigieg campaign. His campaign security officer announced that they're basically filming the presidential candidate all the time, at least when he's awake, so they can disprove any deepfakes that anyone makes of him. And this, on the one hand, is really interesting as a way of kind of getting back that realm, that aspect of trust, right? Of saying, we can prove that he did or he didn't do X. We can prove that this is legitimate, that it's not faked. On the other hand, that's obviously really invasive. And so there's a privacy benefit and a privacy harm in hand at the same time. I mean, what do you think about this as sort of a hint of the road we may be going down?
So I find that enormously creepy. I think that is such a creepy concept, but it's really creepy because I get it. If you think that someday in the near future, maybe, the capability to create very realistic deep fakes becomes very cheap and very easily accessible, it's possible there will be almost no way to disprove a deep fake unless you have a recording of what was happening 24/7 all the time from multiple proven verified sources. And it gets us into science fiction territory. It seems very creepy, but one could argue that the only way to prove the truth of anything in a world where you have people with different opinions on even newspaper truth is having 24/7 data collection from multiple sources all around the world on every single person constantly.
Which seems less than ideal.
I would say that, yes, less than ideal is a good way to talk about that.
And so I think that, you know, it's interesting that you say that because I actually feel like I've seen this trend in journalism recently. It's not as profound, obviously, as filming someone literally all the time or picking up someone's data literally all the time. But there are more and more stories, you know, just in the New York Times, for example, where you can see the reporters kind of including their forensics in the stories that they're writing to sort of prove we really were here when we said we were here. Here are our photos, right? So, and in that way, that trend strikes me as potentially fine, right? Like I don't see anything wrong with a reporter covering their tracks. But I think the question is there any way to, if this is a trend that's heading toward, you know, filming people all the time, keeping all this data in hand, is there an obvious way in your view to head that off and to go a different route? Or is this just something we're kind of careening toward?
Before we answer that, just to kind of layer on top of that, you know, if we kind of play this out a little bit, and if we're heading towards just all information us at all times, right, as a way of disproving something, you kind of get to this ultimate truth of reality, you know, who keeps all that data at the end of the day, right? Is there like a central data hub that it all ends up with, and who regulates that hub? Is that government hub? Like, it's just so much information, right? And I just wonder, like, what does that all look like at the end of the day from a regulatory perspective as well? And in terms of, you know, who is the arbiter of truth then? Is it the machine that holds the data?
Wow, that got to a really scary place. So thank you for that. I guess we're now talking about this sort of, you know, omnipotent AI that holds all the data on all people in the world. And I am uncertain if that is what we want. I'm also uncertain if that is something that privacy law should try to work towards. I do think, though, that we have to try to balance this, right? We want more transparency. We want more verification of the truth, but we need to protect privacy. And there are so many theories for why just this ability to, the ability to lie about yourself a little bit is important, right? The ability to keep some things secret. I think we all sort of know it internally. We understand that if you knew that everyone was watching you all the time, you would act a little differently. When you are on your own at home, or when you're on your own, for example, inside your car or in an elevator, you act slightly differently than if you were in the middle of a large group of people. I think we understand that intuitively, and that need for privacy is something that is very human. So if we're thinking about very long-term future prospects, I think the only way we see that this sort of, you know, idea of an agency or an NGO owning all our data, or any system where we have data collecting about everyone all the time, the only way we see this happening is if a huge societal shift happens and we as a society decide either that we don't care about privacy or we don't care about privacy in that way.
So it strikes me that it is difficult to talk about this as one single society. And when we're talking about sort of the norms that we're developing or the future that we're heading towards, there are multiple competing futures and competing norms in this space. Obviously, you know, the European Union has a much stronger conception of privacy and the right to privacy than perhaps the US. But then there's also, you know, Chinese norms around privacy. So where do you sort of see these this geopolitical privacy battle heading?
That's a really good question. We definitely have different norms of privacy in different countries and different regions. One thing I always stress when I talk to people about privacy on an international level is that at least in most of these semi-open, generally free, generally democratic nations, we actually have much more in common than we have not, right? We generally protect very similar conceptions of many of our rights, including the rights to free speech and free expression, including the rights to privacy and so on. So we're not that different. There are, of course, countries where privacy rights are not respected in the same way. There are many countries where the government has almost total access to any data they want from any company. And that is not so much a function, I think, of a difference in privacy as it is a difference simply in a type of governance. So I think for democratic nations, the changing of privacy norms, I think while we may not be in lockstep with each other, we are sort of moving in a similar direction. The GDPR was obviously a standout regulation that changed the field for many
nations.
That's
the European Union General Data Protection Regulation, is that right?
Yes.
Great.
The EU GDPR. The EU GDPR really changed things for privacy worldwide. But it's not that different from some laws we're seeing in other similar democratic nations and even other nations. For example, in the US, we have the CCPA, which is California's new Privacy Act, which has many similar provisions. And we also have proposals from different states and even on a national level that could enshrine many of the same provisions as the GDPR does. So we're not that different. Something I think should be of concern to people worldwide, though, is this idea of privacy as a right that's unique only to democratic nations. Because often it is in the countries without democratic freedoms where you need privacy the most. And that's something that I am concerned about as a private citizen, but I think we should be concerned about, generally speaking, how to protect privacy and how to protect human rights in nations where those things are not to be expected.
I think just as a follow-up to that on China, you know, it strikes me in all these conversations that differences around privacy and governance of data that, of course, one of the Chinese models for domestic surveillance is to build out the ultimate machine, right, that has the capability to process mass amounts of data from various sources, whether it be facial recognition that tracks an individual's movements in the physical space, whether that be behavior online, whether it be the chats you're having with your friends, medical records, et cetera, et cetera. And they haven't gotten to that terrifying place yet, but they're certainly working towards it. And one of the things that also strikes me that we often talk about the Chinese context, that there's not just cameras everywhere when you're in Beijing or elsewhere. It's also where they are. They're placed in a way that you know you're being watched, and there's so many of them, right? So that you know that at all times your movements and your face are being captured. And of course, that makes people act, as you said, Tiffany, in a different way, inevitably. And I keep going back to one of my favorite, you know, French philosophers, Michel Foucault, and I think about the panopticon, right? And that, of course, is this kind of invisible authority that conditions our behavior. So in a way, those could even eventually just be Potemkin cameras that don't record anything because our behavior already be regulated in the long term. And I think if Foucault had been writing now, he could have, or have been alive now, I should say, he would have never imagined the kind of, you know, digital surveillance state that could be built instead of what he had in mind, which was, you know, kind of based on this 19th century model of a prison, right? Where it's really prison guards and the watchtowers, and eventually all that disappears, but you still act as if you're a prisoner. You still moderate your behavior in various ways. And this is, I think, what's really concerning to me when we're talking about these different visions of data and privacy. It's not really about different visions of privacy. It's really a much deeper contestation of ideologies, right? And my concern is that, you know, that it's going to be very difficult to strike this balance in the Western democratic world, if we can call it that, or just in the democratic world, where we are still progressing in terms of technological development, we're still leading there, yet we're protecting privacy. So that constant trade-off between, you know, privacy and security, or privacy and technology, I'm afraid that we're going to be losing that battle in the very, very near future. But maybe that's just my pessimistic view, just given where the China seems to be heading. Is there a bigger picture here that's more optimistic?
I think there's always an optimistic answer, right? I think that, you know, for every dystopian fiction, there's always a utopian fiction, right? You can consider the future as something that is set in stone and definitely going to be very creepy and very privacy invasive and very scary. But it's also possible that we figure things out a little bit, that we create better tech, that we create better regulations. I think that's the hope. And I think that speaking of international norms or international privacy norms, this is something I've thought about quite a lot as well. I think that one advantage we have right now is that a lot of the technology that we're discussing or we have discussed concerning social media, for example, has come out of these Western democratic states. And with that has come Western democratic norms like free speech and free expression. There's a reason why these companies have taken such pains to create these multiple versions of policies on political ads, on harassment, on hate speech, all of those things. And the reason is because the companies came out of areas and groups of people where these norms of free speech are held so strongly. So I think that the idea of technology as creating the norms is important, right? I'm not necessarily saying that code is law, but I do think that if we maintain a technological advantage worldwide, we also maintain that ability to create or at least influence the spread of technological norms.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. This was a really interesting conversation, and I'm always happy when we can leave it on a little bit more of an optimistic note, given how grim some of this material is. So thanks so much for joining us.
Great. This is fun.
You've been listening to the sixth episode of Arbiters of Truth, the Lawfare Podcast's new miniseries on disinformation.
You can find past episodes in the Lawfare podcast feed, and we'll have new episodes every Thursday. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Tiffany Lee. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Our audio engineer was Jacob Schultz, and our producer is Jen Patya Howell. Please rate and review the Lawfare podcast. And as always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.